The Extra Pack of Peanuts Travel Podcast, Episode 38. The stones used to build the White House come from the Croatian island of Brač, just off the coast of Split. Hey everyone, and welcome back to another edition of the Extra Pack of Peanuts Travel Podcast. Today, I'm joined by Gigi Griffiths, who will be teaching you how to score great deals on long-term rentals for the slow traveler, advice which I used to get an amazing two-bedroom apartment in Split, Croatia for only $500 for 3 weeks, how to travel around Italy as a local, and even how to travel with a pet. She'll also give tips and tricks on how to become a full-time freelance writer or location-independent professional, and discuss the best strategies for not feeling alone as a solo traveler. There's a lot of great info on this week's podcast, so let's jump right in. Hello, travel nerds, and welcome to the Extra Pack of Peanuts Travel Podcast, the show that teaches you how to travel more while spending less. I'm Trav, the creator of Extra Pack of Peanuts, and with me today is the world-traveling, dog-loving, freelance-writing, long-term apartment rental guru, Gigi Griffiths of GigiGriffiths.com. Gigi, thanks so much for coming on the show and welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, and this is going to be a great interview. And Gigi, you wear a lot of hats and do a lot of things, but the most important thing you've done is completely uproot your life about two and a half years ago to embark on this epic adventure. Can you tell people a little bit about your background and how that's led to where you are now?
Sure. So I was living in Denver, Colorado when I decided to travel full time. And I had already been running my own business. My background is in advertising copywriting and creative writing. And so I'd been doing writing for businesses, for websites, etc. And I was already working out of my house. And actually, a friend of mine said to me, well, why couldn't you work from somewhere else? Like, why couldn't you go on vacation in Belize and work from there? And I went, yeah, you're right, I could. Anyway, the idea kind of got planted. I was a little bit unhappy in Colorado. I was antsy for some changes. I wanted something new, something different. So I basically told my clients that I was going to be working remotely from Europe for a couple months, and we would see how it went. And I got rid of my lease. I packed up my things. I put them in a friend's basement. And I went to Europe. And I didn't have an end date in mind, but I just kind of kept it open-ended. That way, if things didn't go well with freelancing or I needed to come back for a client, I could. And a couple years later, I'm still on the road. So it's gone pretty well.
That's awesome. Where was the first spot that you put down then when you headed to Europe? Like, did you have an itinerary fleshed out of, I'm going to go here, here, here? Or was it really just fly by the seat of your pants? I'm going to show up.
I had a little bit of an itinerary, in part because I travel with my dog. And so there is a little bit more planning that has to go into it if you're traveling with a dog, because if you're crossing borders, you have to have paperwork. And you do have to be making sure that you have accommodations that are dog friendly, things like that. So the first place I went was Edinburgh, Scotland. So I planned out 1 month in Edinburgh. I got a place for 1 month. And then I didn't plan any beyond that. And I just had kind of a sketch of an itinerary in my head of where I wanted to go next. And then after I'd been in Edinburgh for a couple weeks, then I started planning, okay, where do I want to go next? What's the next month of my life look like? So I planned about a month at a time.
Oh, and does that still hold true today? Or is it a little more planned out now as we're speaking?
It has varied very greatly over the last couple of years. So at first it was 1 month at a time that I was planning. And then there was a point where I looked at my schedule and I went, holy crap, I have 6 months of my life planned out and I'm going to, you know, four new places. And that was kind of exciting because it meant that I wasn't holding back anymore. I didn't think I was going to fail anymore. I didn't think I would have to go back to the US anymore. And then I've also been in periods where I literally didn't know the next week if I was still going to be in the place I was in or if I was going to be going somewhere else. And so today I actually just recently was granted a year-long residence permit in Switzerland, which is amazing. So I've actually made this my home base for the year and I'm going to be exploring from here. So taking trips out from Switzerland. So right now I can play things a little more by ear just because I have a home base.
Yeah, very cool. And we're going to touch on a bunch of subjects during this interview. One of them, long-term rentals, because you have some familiarity with that and some advice with that. We're also going to talk about how you were able to uproot, become location independent, keep your freelance business and all that. So if people are interested in that, you're going to hear a bunch of stuff. But the thing that really interests me amidst all of this is you travel with your dog. And I don't think we've had anyone on who travels with a pet yet, or at least that we've talked about on the podcast. And we're 38 episodes in now. So I'm sure it makes it a bit more challenging. What are some of the obstacles people should know about when traveling with a pet? So when they're considering, should I bring my pet, should I not? And then what are some things they can do if they say, yeah, I'm going to bring my pet, like it's a no-brainer, they're coming with me, to make it easier, or tricks that you've learned?
Sure. So obstacles, of course, the biggest one is just paperwork. So a lot of places, pretty much all of Europe, North America, South America, you can bring your dog in without any quarantine, which is the thing that people are most worried about. But to do that, you often have to have some paperwork from the country you're coming from. So if I'm traveling, for example, from the US to Europe, then I have to put together some paperwork that says the dog is up to date on its rabies shot, that it is healthy. And that paperwork has to be done by a vet in the US. And then I have to get it stamped by the USDA, which is a pretty simple process. Depending on what state you're in, you go into an office and they stamp it for you and you give them a check. So it's not a huge challenge. It's not really complicated, but it is more work. And you do have to do that usually within 5 or 10 days of travel.
And how does finding accommodations come in? Because I'm sure that is another obstacle, correct? With needing, you know, dog friendly or pet friendly accommodations.
Yeah, it's funny because it's not as much of an obstacle as you'd think. So it's one of those things that you do have to think about ahead of time. You do have to ask and make sure the places that you're going are pet friendly ahead of time. But I would say 90% of the time or more, places allow me to bring the dog. Now, my trick, and we'll talk about this in accommodations too, is that I never take the first answer or the first listing at its face value. So if it says no dogs, or if it doesn't say that it's dog friendly, I always email and I say, I have a small dog, she's non-shedding, she's therapy trained, and because we travel full time, I actually have references for the dog. Here are 3 references that said we stayed in their house and she did not destroy anything. She did not disturb the neighbors, because these are the things people are worried about. And so I would say 90% of the time I get a positive response to that. And they say, yeah, it's, you know, normally we don't allow dogs, but this sounds fine.
Very cool. And then what are some of the benefits of traveling with a dog? Because I'm sure it's going to vary from person to person and pet to pet, but there's obviously a strong reason that you brought your dog and have, you know, toted it to her around, you know, to various countries over 2.5 years. So how is it traveling with a dog? What are the big benefits for you?
Well, so the reason I brought her along is she's my best friend. She's my girl. Like, I couldn't imagine leaving her behind. Like, there was just that wasn't an option for me. But unexpectedly, what I found is a couple other benefits that I really just hadn't thought about at all. And one is that you're automatically like a part of the community. People love dogs. They want to come over and they want to pet your dog. They want to talk to you about your dog. Anywhere I go, if I go to a dog park, I immediately have friends. And so there's this kind of grounding that happens when you're traveling long-term with a dog, where you, any place that you go, you feel like you're automatically a part of something, a part of that community. And the other thing is, the dog really forces you to keep routine. You can't just stay jet-lagged and stay in bed and not go out. You have to take the dog out. You have to take her for walks. You have to go exploring. So even if you're kind of in a cranky mood, the dog forces you to get out there and start experiencing the new city or the new countryside that you're in. And you go, holy crap, like, look at where I am, you know, where you might have just kind of like sat at home that first day feeling jet lagged.
Yeah. So if I had a dog here in Croatia, I wouldn't have been sleeping until noon the last 3 days.
Exactly. Luna would not allow that.
And it's interesting too, because you do write a lot about being a solo traveler. And we say Luna's with you, so I guess you're not technically a solo traveler, but you do write a lot about that. And it's very interesting. And a lot of people out there I know want to travel, but they're afraid to do it because they don't have someone to go with them. And then they automatically write it off as like, well, my friend can't go with me. I don't have a spouse, or, you know, my brother, sister, whatever, can't come with me. I'm just not going to go. What's some of the best advice you can give for people about solo travel? Because you've been doing it now for 2.5 years full time.
Yeah. So I would say that solo travel for me has been kind of a gift. Like, I was actually talking to one of my editors recently about this phenomena where if I've traveled in a group, certainly we meet locals and we meet people along the way. But when you travel solo, you become this kind of magnet for people, especially other solo travelers. People want to talk to you. They want to know what you're doing. And you're not intimidating because you're not in a big group of people. And so I find that people are more drawn to me traveling solo. And I meet so many different people. And I also am forced to get outside of my comfort zone and go approach people and become a little more outgoing, even if that's not what I'm feeling that day. And because of that, I've had experiences that I would have never otherwise had. So actually, when I was in Split in Croatia a few months ago, one of the first people I met was this guy named Ivan, and he was a motorcycle enthusiast, just loved his motorcycle, talked about his motorcycle all the time. And if I had been traveling with someone else, I wouldn't have been able to go on Ivan's motorcycle with him because, of course, he only has one spot on it. And he took me to the top of this hill overlooking the city. It was beautiful. He took me down the coast. We're driving along the coast and looking out at the Adriatic. And, you know, all of these experiences I wouldn't have been able to have if it'd been me and one of my best girlfriends. And so that's what I would say to people if they're nervous about it, is it's going to be a different kind of trip when you're traveling solo. You're going to meet more people. You're going to have different experiences. And you have to go into it willing to kind of grab a hold of those experiences and get a little outside of your comfort zone. And that's something that's going to not only change your travel experience, but really change your life and what you feel you're capable of in the future.
Yeah. And luckily for me, I've been able to do a little bit of that. You know, I usually travel with Heather. And then before that, I was traveling with friends. But I will agree with you 100%. When I first moved to Japan and it was just me for the first 10 days, some of it was because I was just there and I didn't know anything, which is part of why I love traveling. But the other part was it was just me and I'd wander around and people knew, like, hey, here's this foreigner. I was obviously a foreigner in Japan, wandering around and, you know, by himself, and they'd come up to me and talk to me. And that still happened to this some extent when I was with Heather, when I was with a group of people. But it, like you said, it doesn't happen as much. People are very, very drawn to you if they know you're by yourself, because like you said, you're not intimidating. I think that there is some real value to that. What about if someone wants solo travel and they get that, they say, all right, it's going to be a great experience, I want to do it, but are there any like tips you can give to make it easier? You know, places they can go, how they can find people if they are nervous. All right, well, this is my first trip and Gigi says it's easy to find people, but I don't just want to wander the streets by myself. What can they do to kind of form these connections?
Sure. I think there's a few different things. One of the ways that I always found it was really easy to meet people is just staying in hostels. And if you don't want to stay in a room with 10 other people, most hostels have a private room, but there's always some sort of like common area. And so you're downstairs in the common area and there's, you know, 10 other people down there, half of them traveling solo as well. So it's really easy to strike up a conversation, meet someone to spend the day with that way. Another thing that I do all the time is use a site, couchsurfing.com. Now, I don't actually couch surf usually. I don't usually stay at people's houses, but you can get on there and look for somebody who's just interested in meeting foreigners and having a coffee. And so you can email somebody and say, hey, I'm in your town. I don't need a place to stay. I've got my own place, but I would love to go out to eat. Do you have a favorite restaurant you'd recommend? And would you come with me? I'd love to hear about your story and your culture. And that's a really good way to meet local people. And also, even if they can't meet up with you, they might tell you where the best restaurant in town is. You know, they've lived there for 20 years or 30 years or whatever, and they know where the best restaurant is more so than, you know, another traveler might.
Right. That's a great point. And if anyone is interested in couchsurfing, we do have a full interview with Martina Steinman, who is the community manager at Couchsurfing. It is a resource that I always tell people to look into, whether they want to stay with people or whether, like you said, Gigi, they just want to meet people. It's a great community of people who are willing to meet up, have coffee, have lunch, have dinner, exchange information, stuff like that. So a phenomenal resource if you do want to meet some people that are local from that area. So thanks for that recommendation. That's invaluable, I think. And I'm a big proponent of hostels as well. I think everyone who listens to this podcast knows that. But again, the social scene at a hostel is way different than a hotel. You can have your private room and your privacy, but you can also have that nice atmosphere and vibe down in the lounge or the bar or anything like that. So Of course, the big money question is, though, how can someone like you afford to travel full time? And we've had others come on and talk about this as well. But I want to hear your experience with making money from your writing, because I know you said you had started your business before that. How has that changed with traveling full time? And what are some tips that you can give people who are like, all right, I want to do the same thing. I think I have the skill set. How can I get into it?
Yeah. So I would say, as far as affording travel full time, when I went into it, a couple things. One is, I said, I'm going to operate on the same budget or less than what I operated on in the States. And that's kind of the barometer for whether or not I can make this sustainable in a long-term way. And it's one of the reasons that I stay longer in a place, because if you're going to rent something for a month, it's going to be a lot cheaper than if you're renting night by night. And so as far as like keeping expenses low, that's my big thing, is traveling slow and doing it in such a way that I can use the same budget, the same money that I was using back in the States. And like you said, and kind of attached to that, I was already a freelancer before I left. So I already knew about what I was making, about what I could expect to make, when my busy times of year were going to be, and I was going to make good money, and when the lean times were going to be, and I was going to need to pull from the money that I had put away. For me, going on the road, the only thing that really changed is the backdrop. So I'm still doing the same work. I needed to make sure that I had a really good internet connection. I was still working with the same clients, but I was just doing it in a different city. And one of the reasons that I started in Europe and did the full-time travel thing here is that I knew, I was very comfortable that I would have the infrastructure in place to continue doing the work I was already doing. And so my days, you know, especially at the beginning, looked very much the same as they looked in Denver. I would get up, I would work, I would, you know, get my work day done, and then I would have playtime and I would go out and I would explore my new city and, you know, take a lunch break and go to the cafe down the street.
Yeah, very cool. Selfishly, what type of schedule do you keep, and how hard do you find it is to keep a schedule? Because this is one of the hardest things that I found with not only having my own business now, but also traveling, is you're constantly pulled in so many directions, because you're obviously in a new place because you want to be there and you want to explore. But like you said, the work has to get done. Do you set up a schedule of like, I'm working this hour to this hour every day, or is it a little more flexible and free-flowing?
I kind of do and I don't. So,
good answer.
On one hand, I do have like an ideal schedule. I know that my most creative time and my most focused time is the mornings. And so if I can get up and I can hit the ground running and I can get the bulk of my work done, the hardest work, the stuff I have to focus on the most, done before lunch, that's really the goal. Then at lunchtime, I usually take a break. Like, I'm a little bit burned out by then. I've been working hard all morning. Take a little break, maybe take a hike, take a walk around the city I'm in. And then I come back in the early evening, especially when I had clients. And now I'm doing a lot less client work and a lot more magazine writing and book writing. But when I had clients and I was writing websites, many of them were in the US. So their time zone was basically, their morning was my evening here in Europe. And so I would take a break in the afternoon, come back in the early evening, and be available for actual like phone calls and touching base and emailing back and forth with people. And so that's the kind of ideal schedule that I operated on. But I also just chase the sunshine. So if it's a beautiful day outside and I don't know if it's going to be a beautiful day for the next few days, then I may say, you know what? I don't have a deadline today. I'm taking the day off. I'm going hiking, or I'm going to walk around the city, or I'm going to go to the Louvre, or whatever, depending on where I am.
Yeah, and the downside I've found to being your own boss and setting your own schedule is it's hard for me to turn my brain off or to stop at night. Do you have any good recommendations or ways that you say, you know, at this hour, I'm just done? Or do you find yourself, oh, I could do a little more, a little more, a little more? Because that's always been my biggest struggle.
Yeah, I do that as well. I think a lot of us do, because we're very type A. But I think the biggest thing for me is that I started, instead of having a long to-do list of all the things I could get done in a day, I actually started using a system, and I just put sticky notes on my wall. This is my system. And basically at the top of the sticky notes, it says, the only thing you have to do today is, and then I put one or two major like deadline things or things that are coming up soon or whatever. And those are the two or one thing that I have to do that day. And if I get it done by 11 o'clock in the morning, great. If I'm dilly-dallying and it takes me till 3 o'clock, well, then that's my problem. Usually what'll happen is I'll get that done and I'll just still feel motivated. So I'll do a couple other things from the schedule later in the week. But because I'm not having to do that, because it's not an endless to-do list, I'm able to stop easier because I'm like, I've accomplished a lot today versus thinking, crap, I've only gotten through 10 things on my 100 thing to-do list.
Yeah, that's great advice. I think a lot of people overestimate what they can get done in one day, but then underestimate what they can get done in a month or a even longer, like a year. And then you look back after a year like, I did so much, but each day might not feel like that because you're swamped with all these tasks that you have on your to-do list. So I think cutting that down is great advice. And
exactly. The other thing I do is I actually keep a business journal and I go in there about once a week and I write down milestones that I've hit because sometimes it is easy to forget that you've done a lot, especially if you're stressing about the next thing. And I find that if I am stressing and I go back and I look at how much I've accomplished that week, then I feel calmer about whatever the next thing is that I have to accomplish.
Fantastic. Fantastic advice. Now, what are some ways that people can then get started with making money from their own? Because you did it in Denver and you had already started. And, you know, some people might be able to do it from the States or maybe they're already living abroad. But are there websites or resources you can recommend that they check out if they want to be a freelancer, whether it be a writer or an editor or anything like that, but just something that they could do that then would lend itself to location independence?
Sure. I actually get this question a lot and actually was emailing with someone this morning who was asking me about this very thing. And the first question I always ask people is to define what kind of writing they want to do because there are a lot of different kinds of freelance writers. And when people are looking for a freelancer, they really are looking for people who have done the exact type that they're looking for. So for example, my background is copywriting, which is writing for like advertising. So writing a website, writing a marketing brochure, writing a video script. And I used to work for an ad agency before I started my business. And so that kind of writing is a little bit specialized. You need to know different things and think differently about it than if you're writing a creative piece for a magazine or if you're doing technical writing and you're doing manuals for technical products. And so the first thing that I would say, if anyone wants to be a freelance writer and become location independent, you can do it with all these different kinds of writing, but you have to decide what you want to pursue and start reading about that, finding books about that, finding websites that are specific to that. Because a magazine isn't looking for people in the same place that an advertising agency is.
Yeah, great advice. Yeah, niche down to find out what you really want to do and then attack that, and you'll have much more success than if you just throw everything at the wall then.
Exactly, exactly. And if you want to be, you know, a copywriter, if you want to do websites, if you want to do like marketing writing, the way that I got most of my clients when that was the majority of my income was just by networking. So, and you can do that anywhere. I went to networking events when I was in Edinburgh. I made it a point to plan some of my travel around conferences that I knew would be a good networking opportunity. So I went to a conference in London and also got to explore London a little bit. And so you can kind of start to like tweak your travel plans a little bit in order to do some networking. And people love working with people they've met face to face. And you could have clients all over the world because if you're traveling already, then you're already, you know, very capable of popping over to London for a month.
Yeah, face to face is a good recommendation. If you can't go face to face, I've found that for a lot of things that I do, even just hopping on Skype, you feel such a greater connection. You know, even doing podcast interviews with people is a much deeper connection for me with that person than just exchanging emails back and forth. So don't be afraid to put yourself out there and do something that might be a little more, I don't know what the word, advanced than just writing emails. You know, tell them, I'll hop on Skype. Let's talk. Let's talk over the phone because people want to put a human face or a human, you know, voice behind that person rather than just an email.
Exactly. And don't be afraid to reach out to people who are doing what you want to do. So if you want to write books and sell books and you've got a couple bloggers that you love and they're selling books and they seem to be doing well, send them an email. I mean, the worst case scenario, they don't get back to you and you've wasted 5 minutes of your day. But there's no, you know, it's not a real worst case scenario. The best case scenario is they say, hey, let's hop on Skype and they give you some great advice. So don't be afraid to reach out to people who are doing whatever it is that you want to be doing.
Yeah, a perfect segue into my next little question here. The way I found Gigi was through a mutual friend who recommended that I shoot you an email after I said I was looking for a long-term rental property in Croatia. And she said, I know someone who's just there. I think you should, you know, reach out to her, which I did. And true to form, you gave me great advice on snagging longer term rentals here. You know, I consider you a little bit of a guru here. You said you're now bunked down in Switzerland. How long will you be in the rental that you're in now?
Well, my Swiss rental is my longest one abroad, and it's actually going to be for almost a year.
Okay. And can you walk people through what is your process when looking for a longer term rental? Can you just walk us through the experiences that you've had, maybe a certain one that you've done or something like that?
Yeah. So the first place I start, which many of you will already have heard of, is Airbnb. And if you haven't heard of it, basically it's a site where individuals can list a room in their apartment. They can list their whole apartment. They can list a whole house. And you can go and you can rent it for a couple of days. You can rent it for a week. You can rent it for a month. Now, there are a lot of sites out there like this, but the reason I like Airbnb is that the people can actually put in what their price is, not only for the night, but for per week or per month. So instead of having to contact them and ask if they have a discount per month, you can actually put in that you're looking for a month and it'll show you what the price is for a month. Now, the monthly prices tend to be much more affordable and much more along the lines of what a local would pay for a furnished property. And so it becomes, you know, for example, in Paris, I rented a little studio apartment in Montmartre for just over $1,000. And that's something that I had found on Airbnb. So that's the first thing I do is check Airbnb. And the second thing I do, and I talked about this a little bit with the dog thing, is that I don't take things at face value. So I always email before I book something. I don't try to book it automatically. I always email and I ask, is there any discount that you're offering right now? And so, for example, I might say, hey, it's the off season, because I like to travel places when it's the cusp of the season or the off season. And I say, hey, I know it's the off season. Do you have any discounts that you offer for the off season? Can you knock the price a little bit down? Or, hey, I want to stay for 2 months. Do you have a little bit extra you could knock off if I'm doing 2 months versus one? And so always kind of ask if there's that opportunity. And I would say at least 50% of the time, people come back and say, yeah, here's a lower price. Again, because this is individuals that you're working with, you can do a little bit of haggling in a way that you can't really do with a hotel.
Yeah, great advice. I know Airbnb is doing a new thing like Airbnb sublets. It's kind of a subdomain of Airbnb. I just noticed it the other day and I'm not sure it's taken off really well, but that is somewhere someone can check out. It's supposed to be for longer term rentals. But like Gigi was saying, if you go to Airbnb, it should say if they have a monthly rental or a weekly rate, it'll say it, you know, right in their little profile.
Exactly. And so that's kind of where I start. Now, I also like to go to places that are a little off the beaten track and they don't always have Airbnb listings. And so kind of my secondary thing that I do is actually I go to Couchsurfing. And there's two different ways that I've used Couchsurfing that have been fantastic. One is that Couchsurfing has these like forums or communities where sometimes there are people who are just looking for flat shares or roommates or whatever. And sometimes you can find short-term stuff in there. And that's usually at very local prices. So it's a great deal if you can find one of those. But secondarily, in Couchsurfing, you can also put out basically it's called an itinerary and say, hey, I'm coming to your city between these dates and these dates. And instead of asking for a couch to surf on, I, in my message, say, I'm actually looking for a rental. I want to pay for it. Do you have a friend who's going out of town who might rent me their apartment? Do you know somebody who has a place that's empty for a month while it's waiting for somebody else, et cetera? And that message goes out into the community in that area. And so when they log on, they may see your message. I did this in Freiburg, Germany, and I found this beautiful top floor apartment with a gorgeous balcony overlooking the Black Forest for 600 euros for the entire month, which is a steal. And everything on every other site that I found was over $1,000 a month. So anyway, I found it just because someone on Couchsurfing saw my message, wrote to me and said, actually, my friend is going on vacation. Can you tweak your dates, you know, by 2 days and she can rent you her apartment?
Yeah. And the cool thing is it really is a win-win for both people. Usually if someone's going out of town and doesn't mind renting their apartment, obviously they can make some money. And then for you, you know, you get a place cheaper or more authentic. And one of the periphery benefits too of renting a place is if you are renting it from someone or you're getting hooked up with a friend of a friend, then you have a built-in person there to contact as well. So, you know, you want to find the best restaurants, you ask your host, or if your host wasn't there and it was a friend who helped you secure the apartment, then you ask them. And it's just you know, that kind of goes back to the solo traveler, how can I get a little support system before I even kind of arrive type thing.
Exactly. And in the case of Freiburg, actually, like the second night that I was there, the guy who had helped me find the place, we went out to a dinner and had an amazing, amazing schnitzel. So...
And with Airbnb, I will say I do the same, Gigi. I always, you know, some of that was your recommendation of getting a hold of people before and don't take it at face value. I sent emails to a bunch of people and split, and the one we were going to rent actually fell through a day and a half before we were supposed to get 14 hours before we were getting on the train to take a 17 hour train to Split. So 14 hours before we had no apartment, I got on my computer. I just wrote a ton of emails to people on Airbnb, message them saying, here's what I'm looking to do. We're going to be there for 3 weeks. Here's the price that I'm looking to pay. You know, most of them were $70-$75 a night. So 3 weeks, you're looking at, you know, a decent amount of money. And I was able to score a really awesome place in the center of Split, 2 minutes to the beach, 5 minutes to downtown. And we're paying $500 US for 3 weeks. And it's fantastic. It has everything we want. It has 2 bedrooms. The owner is really, really sweet lady. So yeah, don't take it at face value. Always look if you can haggle a little bit, because like you said, it's a person you're dealing with on the other end. Another trick that I learned too is you can see the calendar on Airbnb. So you can see if the place is booked up a lot, or if it's, you know, maybe they have a whole month, month and a half where they only have a few dates filled. That person might be more apt to give you a good deal because it's obviously not as maybe desirable for whatever reason during that time, or, you know, they just don't have someone in. So you can say, oh, I notice you don't have anyone for the next month and a half. Can I have it for a month? And, you know, they'd probably be pretty dumb to turn you down right away without at least kind of negotiating.
Exactly.
Yeah. So people looking for longer term rentals, we talked about Airbnb, we talked about couch surfing. What are some things they should look out for though with long-term rentals? Like, have you had any bad experience or just things that you thought, okay, I wish I knew that before I rented a place because it's different than just going somewhere for a day or two?
Yeah, I have had one or two bad experiences. The first one was just because I had a roommate and he turned out to be just kind of a really like aggressive human being, and it was very hard to live with him. And so for me personally, I look for places to live alone anyway, and that was just kind of a lesson to me to continue doing that. But another place that I went to, I was so shocked because they had like 30 great reviews. Everybody was raving about how much they loved it there. And I get there and you could literally feel the springs in the bed poking your back while you were trying to sleep. And there were cockroaches and there was, and the air conditioner didn't really work. And it was horrible for me. It was just a matter of looking at that and going, you know what? I bet you other people didn't have good experiences and they didn't leave a review. And so this is me circling around to say, please leave reviews and leave honest reviews because it helps all of us. If we all do that, if I get on there and I say, look, this was a bad experience, the springs are poking me, everything, then you can better evaluate whether or not that's a place that you want to rent for a month or two. And again, if you're renting for 2 days, it doesn't really matter. But if you're in there for a month, it's quite a thing.
What then happened with that rental that you had? Was it a longer term rental and were you able to kind of fix the issues?
Yeah, luckily it was a month long rental and I was going to stay for 2 months, but luckily I'd only booked a month because they didn't offer me any special discount to book two. So I only booked the one. So after the first month, I did leave and go elsewhere. We weren't really able to work it out. Part of the problem was that the management didn't really care. But at the end of the day, like I got to be in a beautiful place and I got to do great things. And so I just chalk it up to if I get one bad rental in 2 years, it's not a huge deal.
Yeah. And I had Benny Lewis of Fluent on 3 months on before, and he talked a little bit about apartment rentals because he bumps around pretty frequently as well, about 3 or 4 months in each place. And if someone is a little more of a risk taker, I have not done this myself, but there are two things you can do. One, you can show up in a city and, you know, maybe you have a hostel booked for a night or two or three. And if you're going to be there in that city for a long term, it's not near as big a deal because you can afford to have some time and spend some time looking for apartments and kind of going through them. So you can do that. You can book a place, like I said, a hostel ahead of time for a couple nights and then spend your first couple days looking for apartments. So you do on the ground research there. And you could even just use Airbnb, but then actually meet the people and check it out before you go. Or another one, and this is pretty interesting. And again, I've never done it, but he uses Odesk or Elance, which are freelance websites. He finds someone who's in that area and lives in that town and hires them to then find him an apartment according to his specifications, before he gets in. And so it's kind of like a middleman. So
that's so smart. I love that.
Yeah. I assume you haven't done that then, right?
No, okay. I have not hired someone. I have had friends in a town vet a neighborhood for me. So when I went to Paris, I gave the addresses of my potential rentals to a friend of mine who lives in Paris. And I said, are these okay parts of town? Because especially as a woman traveling alone in a bigger city, I want to make sure I'm in a safe part of town.
Right. And you can also do that then if you don't have friends who live there. Another way to get around that is you can ask on couch surfing. And yes, you don't know those people, but you got to assume that most people who are taking the time to write you back about good places are probably going to be being honest. They have nothing to gain from, you know, kind of telling you a mistruth about that. So
exactly. And if they have lots of great references and lots of people have stayed with them and love them, then they're probably a nice person.
Agreed. Agreed. Now for the really fun stuff and to fill people listening with some wanderlust, what are some of the best travel experiences you've had and places you recommend they go and just things that you've done that you thought, this is why I am out on the road doing this instead of sitting at home in Denver?
Sure. The first thing that comes to mind, and possibly this is because I'm sitting in Switzerland right now, is the town that I'm living in right now, which is called Lauterbrunnen. And it's a small town and it's basically in a valley. And on either side of the valley, you have these enormous peaks. This is the Swiss Alps and these are these beautiful, enormous peaks. Basically, year round, the tops are covered in snow. Absolutely breathtaking, beautiful views everywhere. And the first time I came to this valley, I just remember I stayed in this little camping ground called Camping Jungfrau Holiday Park. And you can rent a little cabin there. And a lot of the cabins have views of the waterfalls because the valley has 72 waterfalls. And so one of like the most magical experiences for me is I just kind of randomly found a mention of Lauterbrunnen in like a sentence somewhere and said, oh, I want to go there. It sounds fun. It's got waterfalls. And I arrived and I just thought, oh my God, like this is my place. Like this is where I want to spend my time. And now, ironically, you know, this was a couple of years ago that I first came. And now, ironically, I'm going to be basing myself here for a year. So one of the best travel experiences was definitely coming here, seeing the waterfalls, walking the paths here. There's a lot of hiking. And the other best experiences that come to mind are all meeting people on the road. So like, for example, recently being in Split, I mentioned this guy, Ivan, that I met who's a motorcycle enthusiast, and he took me all over the coast and told me all about his culture. And he hadn't traveled a lot. And so he's super fascinated by American culture. And we just had these great conversations. And then he would like take me speeding down the road on his motorcycle. And we would be going past all of these mountains that basically go all the way up to the sea. And it was just breathtaking and beautiful. And it was an experience I never would have had if I hadn't just met him.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I think the people you meet really are what travel's all about. But I will say Lauterbrunnen, that was the place that I really, I think, fell in love with travel. And I've told it on the podcast a little bit before, but I was living in Lausanne, Switzerland. I was on a vineyard like right on Lake Geneva, and it was amazing. And then we went to Interlaken and we spent time in the Lauterbrunnen Valley. And I just thought, I don't think there's any going back. Like this is unbelievably beautiful. And
magic.
Yeah. So if anyone is interested, you know, the town is Interlaken right around there. You can go up into the mountains, stay in Murin or Gimmelwald or anything like that. Rick Steves writes a good, good section on it on his guidebook for Switzerland. He loves it. So if anyone's interested more on that, they can go to Gigi's website, check out Rick Steves' guidebook. I'm with you. It's incredible. Like everything is a postcard. You could not take a bad photo.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
You wrote a post that really interesting title here called Confessions of a Less Than Savvy Traveler. And I think most people who read travel blogs assume that people who travel a lot have it all together. They rarely make mistakes. But in most cases, it's actually the opposite. I find a lot of us to be more flighty, or at least myself, and my readers will know I have more than my fair share of goofy travel mistakes and misadventures. What are some of the hilarious mistakes or embarrassments you've had on the road that, you know, have turned into really great stories then after they've happened, or maybe even during while they were happening?
Yeah. Well, so actually that post was inspired because I had a conversation with two of my really good girlfriends who are both super well-traveled, very savvy people. And I was talking about this idea of being a savvy traveler, and they started telling me some of the horrifying things that they had done. And I just started laughing and thinking, oh my God, it's not just me. But anyway, so some of the stories that I told them back, for example, are the first time I was in Italy, I was going going to this town in the Italian countryside in Tuscany. I was so excited. I was going to be staying near a vineyard. I have all my stuff. My bag is on my back. I get on the bus. I ask the bus driver in totally flawed Italian if I'm on the right bus, and he says yes. And 45 minutes later, when we should have been arriving, I start getting nervous and thinking, oh, why aren't we there yet? Why does this not look right? I finally figure out that I had completely botched asking the bus driver where the bus was going and had gone 45 minutes in the wrong direction. And it was one of those things where it was a long travel day, and I got off the bus in the next town and I sat down in front of a shoe store and I just started bawling. And several Italians like ran over and they're trying to comfort me. And eventually I made it to the town. But it's just things, little things like that happen all the time to me where I just take the wrong bus or I make the wrong decision and I have a little meltdown and then it all works out.
Yeah, that's great. And I was actually talking to a friend of mine this morning and we were saying, you know what we should do is put together a podcast of all the misadventures of people that we've had on the show, because it's so true and they make the best stories. And you know, like I got stranded in Singapore because I had messed up my passport before and it sucked at the time, but then it turns out to be a funny story. And yeah, so very cool. Speaking of Italy, you'll be putting out a book very shortly. I know you have a date set. We don't have to give it away if you don't want, but the book is called...
Oh, we can.
All right. It'll hold you to it. So the book is called Italy, 100 Locals Tell You What to Do, Where to Eat, and How to Fit In, which is awesome because I always want that local flavor. I always want to kind of know what I should do that's an authentic travel experience before I go. So can you talk a little bit about how you put together this book, when it's going to come out, and you know, kind of the gist of the whole project?
Yeah. So the idea came from the fact that most of the best experiences that I've had traveling, aside from the fact that just occasionally you land somewhere like Lauterbrunnen and you go, holy crap, this is amazing. Most of the best travel experiences I've had have come from meeting someone local or even an expat who's lived somewhere for a while. So I thought, you know, the travel guides, they're great. They give you a list of the hotels or the hostels or the restaurants, and that's good information to have, but they don't tell you what's the neighborhood with the most local color, or what are the faux pas that the tourists make all the time that if you don't make them, you kind of seem more local. And so I thought, is there any way to give that information in a book without being someone who lives full-time in Italy? Basically, the idea I came up with is interviewing 100 people who do live in Italy. And so these are people who live in Venice, in Florence, in Rome, in the countryside, in the Cinque Terre. And they'll tell you, okay, what's their favorite pizzeria? Not what's the pizzeria that all the tourists go to, but where's the one that's around the corner that doesn't have a sign where you should definitely order this kind of pizza? That's the kind of information that I'm looking for in these interviews and getting from these interviews. And so that's really what the book is local people telling you, you know, how to have the best, most local experience. Yeah, so the book is scheduled to come out on June 2nd, which I'm really excited about. I'm going to be announcing that on my own blog this week.
Awesome. Now, how did you find these 100 locals?
Well, I started with people that I already knew. So I've spent quite a lot of time in Italy. And while I'm there, of course, I try to meet as many people as possible. So I started with people who had been my former landlords and friends and people I'd met along the way. The very first interview I did was a colleague of mine who does writing and who lives in Italy, who I've just been emailing back and forth with for like a year, just talking about cultural differences in being a copywriter. I just had a lot of connections that way. And then I mined all of my friends' connections as well. And I reached out to people on blogs and on Couchsurfing and anywhere that I could find a community that was excited about their city. Those are the people that I reached out to. And I said, you seem like you love your city. Would you tell me about it for a book?
Yeah, that is awesome. That is exactly the type of travel guide that I want to read. So we will be linking all that up in the show notes, guys. So if you are listening to this, you know, while you're driving or doing something else, make sure to head to extrapackofpants.com, get the show notes. That'll be linked up, or to Gigi's website as well. And there's a date on it, June 2nd. So, you know, we're going to have to hold you to that.
Yeah, well, I have to hold myself to it because originally I told people May. So so now we're into June 2nd and that's what we're going to stick with.
Awesome. Well, then what do you have in the pipeline other than that that people should be looking out for, either personally or professionally? Is there anything else that you'll be doing, or is that kind of, hey, gung-ho. We're focused on this book June 2nd. It's coming out.
That's the thing I'm focused on at the moment, but I definitely do have a sketch of an idea of what the rest of the year looks like. I know my readers and I know a lot of people I've talked to are also really, really interested in a few other places in Europe, like Paris and Prague and Geneva. After the Italy book, I'm hoping to put together a few mini ebooks about some of those destinations with maybe 10 interviews in them. And I'm also going to be working on some hiking guides here in the Bernese Oberland in the Swiss Alps. So I'm going to be doing a lot of hiking this summer. I'm planning to actually summit all three of the major peaks in this region, which are Jungfrau, Monk, and Eiger. And I'm going to be writing about that and hopefully putting together some sort of book that will help other people who want to do these same things.
Excellent. That will be fantastic. I look forward to all that stuff, and I'll be following your blog, obviously, with a very keen eye, especially since I love Switzerland and I love Italy. So there you go. Gigi, thanks so much for coming on the show. I love your writing style. I love how you mesh these practical travel tips that we've talked a lot about with your Tales from the Road, which people have got a little bit of a feel for here, but hopefully they come over to the site, they can read a lot more. I know you're an inspiration for many people out there, especially solo travelers, you know, and getting them to take the plunge. Before I let you go, can you remind people one more time how they can come connect with you? Where can they find you?
Well, the website is ggriffiths.com. So you can obviously find me there and connect with all my social networks there as well. You can also find me on Facebook. There are only two Gigi Griffiths, so you should be able to find me pretty easily. And on Twitter, I'm also at Gigi Griffiths. So pretty much everything is just Gigi Griffiths. If you Google me, the first 10 results are all me.
Perfect. Thanks again for coming on. I might just have to sneak back over there to Lauterbrunnen sooner rather than later now.
Sounds great. Let's go for a hike.
Thanks, Gigi.
All right. Ciao.
Hey guys, if you like what you heard today from Gigi, make sure to head on over to her website, ggriffiths.com. That's GIGIGRIFFIS.com. Read all her awesome travel stories and the great actionable advice she shares over there on her website. Also, I'm super excited for her book on Italy to come out, her local guidebook on Italy. If you want more information about that, you can head to her website. There's a newsletter you can sign up for. So when that is launched on June 2nd, you'll be one of the first people to know. If you're listening to this podcast after June 2nd, I urge you, go on over, check out her website, grab that Italy Like a Local guidebook. I think it's going to be worth its weight in gold for those people who want to head to Italy. And really, who doesn't want to head to Italy? Lastly, if you're listening to a travel podcast, that probably means that you want to travel more, and I want to help you do that. And the easiest way for me to help you travel more while spending less is for you to go over and sign up for the Extra Pack of Peanuts email newsletter. And you can do that by going to extrapackofpeanuts.com/free. By signing up for the newsletter, you'll be getting email updates anytime we put up a new podcast, as well as anytime we put up a new post to the site. You're also going to get our free copy of Become a Frequent Flyer Millionaire, which is going to set you on the path of how to start acquiring frequent flyer miles and really start traveling around the world for next to nothing. So extrapackofpeanuts.com/free. You can sign up for our email newsletter. You can stay abreast of everything that's happening on Extra Pack of Peanuts, and I can help you start to travel more while spending less. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in once again to another edition of the Extra Pack of Peanuts podcast. I'll see you next week, and until then, happy free travel.